All right, I call this meeting of the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee to order. We will be meeting under Rule 10.01, allowing us to meet remotely. We'll start with the roll. Anna, please go ahead.
Chair Becker Finn.
Here.
Representative Mueller.
Here.
Here.
Representative Scott.
Here.
Representative Feist.
Here.
Representative Frazier.
Here.
Representative Grossel.
Here.
Representative Herr, excuse. Representative Hollins.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Liebling.
Here.
Representative Long. Representative Mortensen. Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Here.
Representative Robbins.
Here.
Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Here.
All right, a quorum is present. We do have three bills that we're going to be moving today. But first, we need to do the approval of the minutes for February 4th. Representative Feist, do I have a motion to approve the minutes?
Yes, so moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Feist. Any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? All right, the minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Feist, for having your camera on, so I knew you were sort of paying attention. The first bill on the calendar today is House File 39. It is a Representative Carlson bill. We will keep the focus of the discussion on Section 4 of the bill, which are the enforcement provisions and is the area that our committee has jurisdiction over. Representative Carlson, welcome to our committee. Since you are not on this committee anymore, I will move your bill. I move that House File 39 be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means. You do have an amendment. It is the A2 amendment, members. In my conversation with Representative Carlson, it's a technical amendment that puts the bill in the shape that the author wants. I will move the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion to the A2 amendment? All right. Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right. The amendment is adopted. Representative Carlson, your bill as amended is now before us. Please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Representative Andrew Carlson, and this is House File 39. The purpose of House File 39 is to promote economic recovery in the state of Minnesota by requiring certain hospitality employers to rehire their workers laid off during the pandemic. House File 39 would require covered employers to offer workers laid off since January 31st, 2020, the option to return to their job by classification and seniority. There is also protections for workers if their employer's operation is sold or transferred. Covered employers are those operating a hotel with over 75 rooms, large event centers, building maintenance and security services, airport hospitality. So as many of you are aware, the hospitality industry is a major employer in Minnesota, and its employees, many of whom are immigrants and people of color, have been especially hard hit by COVID-19. In April 2020, more than half of the hospitality workers in the metro area had lost their jobs, and recovery has been slow. By October 2020, employment in hospitality was still 30% less than it was a year earlier. Without policy action, workers who lost their jobs through no fault of their own could be left facing a challenging labor market already rife with racial disparities. Workers in the hospitality industry are disproportionately people of color. As a result, this population has borne the brunt of the massive layoffs that have occurred because of the pandemic. At hotels especially, laid off workers are nearly 90% people of color and mostly women. Ensuring the rights of these workers to return to the jobs they held pre-pandemic as business allows, is a critical issue for racial justice as our economy recovers from COVID-19. In addition to protecting workers, House File 39 helps achieve a key ingredient for the speed of our overall state economy, which is maintaining established employer-employee relationships. Research has shown that established employee-employer relationships are critical to the speed of the overall economic recovery. So in conclusion, this common sense legislation will help stabilize an important part of the Minnesota economy as businesses and workers alike recover from the COVID-19 crisis. So Madam Chair, those are just some opening remarks, kind of putting in context the importance of the bill, as well as some of the factors to which it would cover. I know we are focused on a narrow portion of the bill as it was amended. I know we have some testifiers as well, so probably best to get to those before taking questions, I would imagine. Okay.
Yep. All right. Thank you, Representative Carlson. We will get to the testifiers. First on the list, I have Wade Lundberg. Not sure if I'm pronouncing that correct, but Mr. Lundberg, if you please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Becker-Finn. It's Lundberg. I'm one of the German ones from southwestern Minnesota. So good morning and good morning, committee members. My name is Wade Lundberg, political director of Unite Here, Local 17, Minnesota's hospitality union. We represent workers in the Twin Cities Convention Centers, major sports facilities, workers at MSP International Airport in in-flight catering and concessions, and in union hotels across the metro and Rochester. Today, I ask that you consider and pass this important piece of legislation on behalf of some of Minnesota's most vulnerable citizens who lost their livelihoods through no fault of their own during the scourge of COVID-19. I can think of no industry of workers that's been more impacted by continued joblessness than those in hospitality since the onset of the pandemic, and that those job losses that played out just over a period of days further left workers dismayed and hopeless from what were generally long-time careers in service to others. That was equally damaging to them. 1 in 10 workers in Minnesota are in the wide-ranging sectors of hospitality, and nearly 120,000 workers initially lost their jobs, a 30% year-over-year drop in employment in the Twin Cities leisure and hospitality sector alone. And while there are parts of the industry, particularly the restaurant sector, that has a brighter future ahead, we continue to see chronic unemployment in our airport, accommodations, and events sectors, with projections of a very long road to a full recovery stretching into 2023 and 24. Equally damaging to workers in the hotels and events work is the impact on women and our BIPOC communities. Most workers in this part of the industry are a majority of women and people of color. And as we know, these same communities are also impacted at much higher rates in healthcare access, delivery, and may have worse outcomes in the pandemic. At Minnesota's largest hotel, 69% of regular full-time workers who were furloughed in 2020 were people of color. At the largest airport concessions operator at MSP, 71% of those who lost their jobs since March of 2020 are Black or African American, and 2/3 are women. Without policy action, workers who lost those jobs could be left to face a challenging market. Here, as legislators, you're in receipt of a report demonstrating the incredible challenges faced by laid off or separated workers in the industry. Today, you'll also hear testimony from two longtime hotel workers. The intent of House File 39 is to secure a path back into those jobs and careers and livelihoods that folks built for themselves and their families. It calls on employers and workers to follow an orderly process that brings back their incumbent workforce first, and as business levels allow, before hiring new workers with less experience. There is no expectation that any given hotel or convention center will need all workers back on a certain date, but again, as business levels allow, and knowing that recovery will be year over year. What I do know in this industry, and that the people in this industry are incredibly resilient. They want to go back to work, to the work they know, and the livelihoods they built for themselves. Today, we ask you to pass House File 39 that creates an orderly path back to work for these Minnesota citizens and speeds Minnesota's economic recovery. And thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Luneberg. I have next on the list, I have Tamara Houston. Ms. Houston, please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Tamara Houston. I work at the Delta Hotel in Minneapolis by Marriott. I worked there since 2016, but I've been laid off since March of 2020 because of COVID. I love my job at Delta. I love the people that I work with. And before I COVID, I had a lot of customers that would come back regularly because they would always come to the same hotel on business. I got to know them, and I want to be back there. When I found the job, I never planned on having another job before I retire. It was the first time in my life I was able to only work one job. I had never had a job that I wanted to stay at for the rest of my life, but I worked long and hard to get to where I am. Being laid off for so long has been really hard. I need to work. I'm going to be 60 years old in April, and I've applied for about 20 other jobs, but only had 3 interviews and haven't gotten any of them. I've never been turned down for a job in my life, so it was a little shocking for me. It was a little bit of a wake-up call. If we don't go back to work, what am I going to do? It's getting scary. Even if I find another job, what are the chances? How many warehouses are going to hire me at my age? I can't lift a lot. I've done office work before, but would have to reacquaint myself with computer skills. But if I have to do it, I will. I don't think we should be punished for something that was out of our control. COVID-19 took a lot from a lot of people. We're not out of work because we don't want to work. We're not working because we can't. If we loved our job before COVID-19, there's no reason we shouldn't be able to know we can go back to that job. I think enough people have given up enough or lost enough in their life without giving up the job that they love. And that's all I have to say today. Thank you.
Thank you very much for testifying in front of the committee. We really appreciate it. I do want to note for the record that Representatives Long and Mortensen did join us shortly after the roll call. I believe we had a third testifier. Mr. Luneberg, could you let us know the name of that third testifier?
That would be Leona Williams, and I'm not sure I'm seeing her on here.
Okay, I wasn't sure if we had a replacement testifier for her. So we will go ahead with member questions. I see there are a couple of hands up. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. My question is for Mr. Luneberg. Mr. Luneberg, do you have some reason to believe that the people that were laid off from these jobs wouldn't be called back? It seems to me we're putting a lot of law into statute here that is just reinventing the wheel. If these people had these jobs to start with, why are we assuming that they wouldn't get those jobs back?
Mr. Luneberg.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative Botany. I think it's important to understand that that some of these operations are huge, event centers, convention centers, airport concessions, and that we are moving up to nearly a year where the majority of these workers were laid off in the restaurant industry today. In that piece of the industry, it's fair to say that they are doing better. With 50% occupancy and so many workers returning to those operations. But we are still experiencing anywhere from 75-85% unemployment at the airport, in our sports facilities, in our convention centers, and in our hotels. And the longer workers are separated from their operations, whether it's laid off, furloughed, or that a WARN notice has gone out, a permanent separation, without some kind of thread to connect those workers with those operations, operators may move on to hiring new people with less experience.
Any follow-up, Representative Novotny?
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn. Do you have any numbers to support that? I think we're just reinventing the wheel here. I understand the thought that they may be separated, but what would be the advantage to a business to hire a new employee that they would have to train from start? Thank you.
Mr. Lunenburg.
Chair and representative, to your point, I think it's important that folks with experience are brought back in an orderly fashion. And again, between the operator and the worker, the operator would make an offer of employment back into a classification that the worker recognizes, and the worker in return needs to respond and accept that offer before they hire new people with less experience.
Next on the list is Representative Johnson. I will remind members, I know we have a lot of hands up, but we're going to try to stick to Section 4, which is about the enforcement and rulemaking and is the piece of the bill that we have jurisdiction over. Representative Johnson, please go ahead.
Chair Becker-Finn, this question is geared towards Representative Carlson dealing with this issue. I know a number of companies, not just in the hotel or the bar industry, the restaurant industry, but in other companies as well. They have offered, got back started, offered former employees their positions back, and for some reason or another, they refuse, whether it's for issues dealing with COVID or other health issues. And these companies have actually had to hire new people. Now, with this bill, my question to Representative Carlson is, if we pass this and this becomes law, those people that turn down the opportunity to come back to work, these companies have hired people to replace them, new employees, trained them, are they going to have to fire that employee that was took that open position because the previous employee refused to come back, so that new previous employee gets their job back, and who's going to have to pay the workers' compensation or the unemployment insurance and the fines for that because that person was fired, because we had a law that said the other person that previously had the job now gets their job back?
Will point members to the effective dates on Section 6, but Representative Carlson, go ahead with your response.
Yes, thank you, Chair. That's really the starting point for this, is the bill anticipates these types of issues. So by having those effective dates, also the law only requires employers to rehire qualified employees. There are mechanisms within the bill to get to those types of nuances to ensure that through the qualifications and seniority that there is a vetted process in ensuring that those workers get back to their previous jobs. And again, if they have turned down the employment, that would trigger the notification to them, but this is all anticipated within the bill.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
I just have concerns that there's a way that I think businesses are going to be nervous on this, and even there's some issues that need to be taken care of. I don't think that section completely covers it. Because they could say they don't want the job, and then down the road want it back again. Even though you have some things in place, I think it's got to be looked at a lot closer, and I have a lot of concerns on it.
Okay, and members, if you don't have the bill in front of you, I would encourage you to bring it up on your computer so you can actually see the bill and have it in front of you. I know it's a little bit difficult when you don't have it just handed to you in committee, but would encourage you to do that. And we've got a little bit of time, so I'm allowing some leeway in not just talking about Section 4, but would remind members that that really is the focus here. Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for Representative Carlson, if I may. Representative Carlson, does this bill have a Senate companion?
Representative Carlson.
Representative Grossel, Chair Becker-Finn, yes, it does. I believe that bill will be introduced today by Senator Bobby Joe Champion in the Senate.
You believe it has a Senate companion, but it does not have
Representative
one. Excuse me, Madam Chair. Can I go ahead?
Thank you. Yep. Okay. Thank you.
Yes, Dave. It's hard to teach an old dog new tricks with his Zoom stuff. challenging at times, but you believe it has, it does not have a Senate companion yet, is what you're saying. Madam Chair, I guess for everybody's benefit, why are we hearing bills that have no Senate companion that are going to go nowhere, essentially, when it comes time to cutting the fat off of everything? And the simple resolution to this whole situation, why do we need legislation to put people back to work when all we have to do is open things back up and let Minnesotans go back to work? One of the testifiers put it very plainly and very simply. She wants to go back to work. So I guess I don't need Minnesotans, the labor force, the unions, all these people that are out there, they don't need legislation to tell them to go back to work. The COVID/governor shutdown has hamstrung all these businesses. So, I mean, to be spinning our wheels on this kind of stuff when we have the authority and the power to put people back to work immediately and to do it safely and in the right way, why are we doing this? It's 8:30 in the morning, 8:51 now. Don't we have things that we could be working on that would actually benefit our citizens? Thank you for indulging me, Madam Chair.
Yep. Thank you, Representative Grossel. Back to your question about hearing bills that don't have Senate companions yet. We are many weeks away from deadline. And, you know, there are many reasons, especially right now when we can't just walk over and safely hand the yellow jackets to our senators. So, you know, we'll take members' words for whether they have Senate companions or not, unless they prove us otherwise. With that, I do not see any other hands up. Representative Carlson, any closing remarks regarding your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Again, thank you for hearing House File 39. And again, I'll just leave you with a quick summary of the importance of this. And this was also mentioned in my opening comments as well, that this legislation will help stabilize a very important part of the Minnesota economy so that businesses and workers alike can recover together. That's what's really going on here. We want to ensure that everybody is reaping the rewards of the recovery. You know, we're finally to a point now where we're not just reacting to a crisis before us, but to actually be able to plan for the future and making sure that we leave nobody behind. So thank you all for your time today, and appreciate your support.
All right. Thank you, Representative Carlson, and thank you to the testifiers. I will renew my motion that House File 39, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Anna, please go ahead with the roll.
Chairmaker Fenn.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Herr, excused. Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
No.
Representative Novotny.
No.
Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Robbins.
No.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
Okay. I have nine ayes and seven nays.
All right, the motion prevails. House File 39, as amended, is recommended to be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you, members. We'll move on to the next bill, which is House File 333, regarding reverse mortgages. It is a Representative Katiza Watoon bill. I believe we've got Representative Katiza Watoon on. I will move that House File 333 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. Representative Katiza Watoon, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good to be here in Judiciary this morning. So House File 333 is a reverse mortgage bill. It's come back from last session. We were actually in the queue to be heard in Judiciary when we made the accommodations for COVID in the spring of last year. So to give a overview of the bill, and I have a couple testifiers today, but in order to better support our seniors as they're aging gracefully and wish to age in place in their homes, this bill is designed to protect them by preventing unnecessary foreclosures of reverse mortgages. Very sadly, both here in Minnesota and across the country, reverse mortgages and foreclosures are an increasing problem. So this bill does three things. Provides the opportunity to designate a third party to receive notices of defaults and delinquencies that could lead to foreclosure, requires the servicer to send those notices to that third party, and gives the borrower the opportunity to stop a foreclosure if the notices were not sent to all parties involved. Unlike a traditional mortgage, a homeowner doesn't make monthly payments to the lender, but instead the lender makes payments to the borrower, and they tap the equity in their home to obtain income to stay in the home and age in place. The interest-bearing loan is repaid when the homeowner no longer uses the home as their primary residence. For example, if they're forced to move into a nursing home or make other accommodations. The homeowner still does need to keep current on their property taxes and homeowner's insurance and periodically or annually attest that the home is still their primary place of residence. The loan comes due when the home is no longer that primary residence. And in a 2019 report, the General Accounting Office indicated that defaults on reverse mortgages have risen almost tenfold, from 2% in 2014 to 18% in 2018. The problem that this bill seeks to resolve is that due to diminished capacity, more and more elders are defaulting on taxes or insurance and potentially not returning those documents to lenders that certify their ongoing residence in that home. Consumer advocates are, you know, seeing continually more of these cases, and this is a simple solution. I'm going to let Mr. Ron Elwood of Legal Aid kind of take it away, and I'll stand for questions later on. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Katiza Watoon. Mr. Elwood, please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Members, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and I want to thank Representative Katiza Watoon so much for bringing this bill. It's something that we've been grappling with here at Legal Aid, but also seeing the same thing from our partners in the housing counseling arena. You'll see a letter from Catholic Charities in your packets that supporting this bill. And in addition, the Homeownership Center, Habitat for Humanity, and Lutheran Social Service are all in support of the bill. Representative Katiza Watoon and her partner there on screen have explained this very well. I'll just be available for questions, and I'll let my colleague, Brittany McCormick, staff attorney at Legal Aid, just tell a very brief story that will illustrate the problem and explain why this is a great solution. But I do want to first just thank a number of the organizations that we vetted this bill with and who provided us a review and some feedback that have been incorporated into the language. And so really like to publicly thank the Minnesota Bankers Association, the Minnesota Credit Union Network, the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota, the Minnesota Land Title Association, and the Minnesota State Bar Association. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll conclude my remarks for the moment. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. We do, as you mentioned, we do have Brittany McCormick here. Ms. McCormick, if you could unmute yourself and introduce yourself and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Katiza Watoon, for supporting this bill and sponsoring it. So I'm Brittany McCormick. I'm a staff attorney at Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. I've been there for about 5 years, and reverse mortgages are a big part of my practice. I do homeownership exclusively, and a lot of our clients that come to us are seniors or family members of seniors that have figured out that the property taxes have gone unpaid. And in a reverse mortgage situation, that is a very dangerous situation for the senior. It gives the servicer, the mortgage servicer, a cause to foreclose on the home, even though the whole idea of a reverse mortgage is that the senior gets to stay in their home until they're no longer able. And a big reason behind the missed property tax payments, sometimes it is, you know, they're on Social Security and they don't have enough money, but a lot of times it's because they do not have the wherewithal due to diminished mental capacity to make those payments. They also perhaps missed one of those. Every year they receive a single card in the mail that requires them to certify occupancy, and that often gets lost in the shuffle or just forgotten about. I had a client who the husband was, you know, took care of all the finances in the relationship for the majority of the relationship. He's the one that got Alzheimer's, and one of the symptoms of his Alzheimer's disease was that he would hide documents from his wife. So she was totally unaware that he was not paying the property taxes and that the house was, you know, in danger of reverse mortgage foreclosure. Luckily, she figured it out when they got a notice of, you know, upcoming sheriff sale. We were able to figure out a solution for them that kept them in their home. But a lot of seniors, you know, there is no spouse. A lot of seniors are living alone. And so this bill is designed to get someone in their life involved in the problem before it gets to a lawyer, or if they're lucky enough to get to a lawyer. So really, this is a non-legal problem that can be solved by, you know, a son or a daughter or a trusted friend that intervenes early. And that's what this bill is aimed to do. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for your testimony. I will go to member questions. Representative Mortensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the story that the last testifier gave us that said, one of these symptoms of Alzheimer's was hiding documents. And of course the disease was Alzheimer's. And I can't help but kind of correlate that back to the problem statement that we were given when we were told that the problem is people are defaulting on their income taxes or their property taxes, and then they're not sending in proper documentation. So as I'm reading the bill, I don't quite understand how this addresses the problem of property tax statements being missed. It feels like this bill is treating the symptoms and not the disease itself. So I'd like to understand, how does this actually address the fact that an increasing amount of seniors are defaulting on the property taxes?
Representative Katiza Watoon, do you want to try to take that, or Mr. Elwood?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Mortensen, for the question. So the bill itself allows for people, when they are applying to obtain a reverse mortgage, to basically name a third party, and that could be, you know, a trusted family member, a trusted neighbor, whomever they choose, and then that person receives the notices throughout the year at the same time as the borrower. So then that person can check in with them to say, hey, you know, it's property tax time. Those property taxes are coming due. Have you already paid them this year? Did you get that annual recertification statement that you're still living in this home? And basically just allowing that person to be kind of an oversight if the homeowner chooses to do so.
Representative Mortensen.
Got it. Yeah, I don't see how this enables people to make their income tax or their property tax payments. I can see that's, I don't know if I support the bill or not, quite honestly, right now. I think it probably makes some sense, but I don't see it addressing the root cause. So going back to that story of a symptom of Alzheimer's is hiding documents, it feels like we're helping somebody unhide their documents instead of treating the Alzheimer's disease itself. And I think there are probably much more effective solutions here. If the problem is seniors, and I hear it all the time, seniors can't make their property taxes because they keep going up so high and we're taxing their income on Social Security. So I think there's far better solutions to address the problem than this bill.
I guess I will say we are not going to be able to cure Alzheimer's here in the Judiciary Finance Committee, but it looks like Ms. McCormick has a response to your comments. Ms. McCormick.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Mortensen. I can explain a little bit more about the reverse mortgage process, the foreclosure process, and that might shed some light on your question. So when someone misses their property tax payment, if they have a reverse mortgage, the reverse mortgage servicer goes ahead and pays it because they're protecting their asset. That begins a relatively long foreclosure process, but it does move along. And at some point, if the senior does not pay the arrearage or, more importantly, come to a repayment plan with the servicer, which is definitely a realistic goal, and I've had many clients where we were able to get into a repayment plan that saved the house from foreclosure, that's the window of opportunity to do it. And so if a member of that person's family, if they have diminished capacity, it's essential that they get involved because they often have, you know, the money to contribute to the senior's income. If the senior has the money but just forgot about the property tax payment, they can, you know, get them to make the payment, or they can get them on a repayment plan. A lot of these repayment plans involve a lot of, frankly, hours on the phone with a mortgage servicer, which is something that is not, you know, doable for a lot of seniors in this position. So really, if they can get someone in their life that they trust involved at an earlier stage in the foreclosure process, they have a good shot at avoiding the foreclosure and keeping their home. That's what this bill is designed to do. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. McCormick. The other hand I have up is Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to kind of add to the conversation, you know, some elderly people are used to having their mortgage, traditionally, their mortgage payment rolled into their taxes, insurance, all of that rolled into one payment. This is quite different. A reverse mortgage is quite different than that. And so just as we've done I think the last couple of years in making a third party aware of investment decisions that an elderly person is making, that's what this is doing. And it's a protection for the elderly person. So as you said, that they can stay in their home. That's the whole goal of this. Just ask Tom Selleck, right? He's their guy. We don't want him to lose that job. So, but this is an important bill to protect seniors. And if the bill's author or maybe the testifier could just speak to the protections built in so that that third party would not take advantage of this older person, maybe that would be helpful too. But I think this is a good bill. I plan to vote for it.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Representative Katiza Witun.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott, for your support and for that opportunity to clarify. I don't, Ms. McCormick or Mr. Elwood, would you like to go a little bit further into the remedy on the side of the borrowers or the loan companies?
Yep, Mr. Elwood.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and thank you, Representative Scott, so much for that. And to answer your question, there are protections built into the bill that do not, for example, create any powers of attorney or create any authority for the third party to act on behalf of the borrower. All it does really is it's essentially an early alert bill. So the idea is to catch these problems way upstream, because when we get them, the home has already gone into foreclosure. The sale may have already taken place, or it's imminent. This bill is intended to go way up the front so it doesn't ever get there. It's intended to do one of two things. If A is to keep the borrower and the elder borrower in their home, if at all possible, and if there's an issue about paying property tax or homeowners insurance or whatever, and the son in California, or the daughter in Vermont, identifies this at the first instance, then they can correct the issue about the payments. It's also, as an ancillary benefit, is to identify a capacity problem. And if, in fact, unfortunately, maybe the borrower can't stay in the home because they need to move into a facility, that would also catch that problem early on. So I hope that responds to your question, Representative Scott.
Any follow-up, Representative Scott?
No, thank you.
All right, thank you. One last question, Representative Johnson, and then we will move to the vote.
Chair Becker-Finn, I want to thank Representative Katisa-Watoon for this bill. I understand it greatly. My mother, who were dealing with the onset of dementia and other issues, we have actually, with some of the bills, have already have it set up where the going to talk with some of the people to get those notices and all the bills, a copy of it sent to my sister, who's the executive, who handles those issues right now. And I think it's a very a good thing to set up for these things, especially when it comes to the mortgage of the house, because that a lot of elderly people, that is their retirement and their assets. It's bad enough that when they go into the nursing home, sometimes the state actually takes that property away from them because of they can't pay the bills for the nursing facilities and for the care they need, instead of giving it to the family, because they've done a lot of work and to get those assets, and now the state comes in and takes them away. So this is a way to keep them in the family, and sometimes it could even be the family farm or the family business. So I think this is a good opportunity to make sure those things are kept in the family where they belong. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Katisa-Watoon, any closing comments before we move to the vote?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity. I appreciate your support. I think this is a good bill. It's going to help a lot of families.
And thank you for bringing the cutest co-testifier we've had in this committee so far this year. I will renew my motion that House File 333 be recommended to be placed on the general register. Anna, please go ahead with the roll.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
Aye.
Representative Herr, excused. Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
Aye.
Representative Novotny.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
There's 16 ayes.
The motion prevails, and House File 3333 is recommended to be placed on the general register. And with that, members, I am going to virtually hand the gavel over to our Vice Chair Mueller, since the next bill on the agenda is one of mine. So, Vice Chair Mueller, you have the wheel.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I have my virtual gavel here, too. Thank you. So, members, our last bill up today is House File 312, Court-Appointed Counsel Requirement in Child Protection Cases Modified. This is Chair Becker-Finn's bill. And, Chair Becker-Finn, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I would move that House File 312 be recommended to be re-referred to Human Services, Finance, and Policy Committee.
Thank you. And I do understand that you have an author's amendment. Is that correct?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. It is the A1 amendment. It essentially just gets the bill in the shape that I would like and gets it more in line with current practice.
All right. So we will move to a voice vote on adopting the A1, but just to take a minute here and see if there are any questions regarding that amendment. All right, seeing none, no questions or discussion on adopting the A1 author's amendment. All those in favor, please unmute and say aye.
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 Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. And Chair Becker-Finn, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So House File 312 regarding representation of parents or guardians in child protection proceedings. So right now in child protection cases, there is no guaranteed right to counsel for parents and guardians. Current statutory language is permissive. Counsel shall be appointed, but only if the judge feels that such an appointment is appropriate. And so there's a lot of sort of leeway there that's given to the judge. This bill addresses that by requiring that the court appoint counsel if the parent wants counsel and if they qualify financially. It's essentially the same qualification that one would need to qualify for a public defender. The heart of this bill really is that families should be together. Of course, safety is paramount in child protection cases, but these cases are often messy and the best course of action is not always clear. And we know that separating children from their parents is traumatic for the children and the parents and the rest of the family, and that this can have reverberations really for generations in a family. For any of us who are parents, I don't know that there's anything more core to a thing that I know that is true than that I would do anything for my kids. And so that's really the heart of this bill. The separation of children from their families via the child welfare system has historically disproportionately impacted children from BIPOC families as well as low-income households. The color of your skin or the amount of money you have should influence the outcome in these cases. In order to reduce unnecessary removals of children from their parents, we should all support a balanced system where each party is represented by counsel. And this will result in better results because all sides will be represented by trained professionals. I know this will cost money, and I'm working with DHS and other stakeholders to make sure we are doing this in the way that is most economically feasible and sustainable. But those financial implications will be addressed more thoroughly in the Human Services Committee, since that is where that is the budget that would be impacted. And before we even get to any questions about it, there's also concern about finding the necessary attorneys to represent these parents. With technology now in place post-pandemic, we know that we are capable of much more from a distance than we used to think possible. The effective date isn't until mid-2022, and we'll continue to work with stakeholders to make sure that this can become a reality. 41 other states throughout the country have figured out the logistics, and I'm sure that if we commit to this, that we can also figure it out here in Minnesota. Minnesota is one of only 8 states that does not provide a right to counsel in these cases, and we need to do better. And I do have several testifiers, Madam Chair, and I would like to turn it over to them.
All right. Thank you, Chair Becker Finn. Is Joanna Woolman testifying, or is she just available for questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. She's just available for questions. We really want to get to Ms. Wade and some of the other testifiers.
All right, very well. Ms. Wade, if you can introduce yourself and begin your testimony, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and thank you so much. Appreciate it. And committee members, can you hear me?
Good.
Am I okay? Okay. My name is Lorraine Randall Wade. I am the executive director for an organization called Minnesota One Stop for communities, where we provide parent mentors to parents who have children in out-of-home placement, and the parent mentors are able to help parents navigate the child protection system to be reunified with their family. One of the things I know, as long as I've been doing this work, and it's been since quite some time, since 2012, since I've been doing this work, parents who appear at court because they have a child protection case, who do not have an attorney present with them, find themselves really lost. The system is already scary enough. And when they do not have representation there, they don't know what to say. They don't know what not to say. They don't know what questions to ask, or they don't know the direction in which to go. I often talk to parents who don't have that representation at the first hearing to kind of calm their nerves and begin to ask questions to the right people about, can they receive representation? And if so, when can they get some? When can someone call them or consult with them? At child protection court is almost like you are guilty. Period. You don't get to prove that you're innocent. You're just guilty. Based on the report that was screened in, and the children being removed from home, you're guilty and you don't get a chance to prove your innocence. And it's different from our criminal court, where in criminal court, there is an attorney there with the individual that's been accused of a crime. There is such grave importance in this process. And I believe a lot of children can be returned home quicker if there was representation at the onset when the parent has to enter into court for various different reasons. Sometimes children can go home right away. Sometimes children stay in the system longer than what they should stay in the system because parents lack the knowledge and the resource to have someone there advocating for them on their behalf. And effective representation at that, someone that knows the child protection laws, the statutes, and are able to challenge what the statute is, because all parents don't fall under the same statute. Whereas sometimes in this state, when parents receive child protection cases, they kind of apply all statutes to all parents, no matter what they are. And it's not fair to the parent. It's not fair to the children. It's not fair to the family. So I am all for parents having effective representation at the onset, because I see a lot of our parents suffer in the beginning without that, especially parents in rural counties that don't have access, and an attorney has to come away from another county to provide this representation for them. They miss out on a lot, and the clock is ticking. Once a court date, the EPC hearing happens, the clock is ticking, and it doesn't stop because parents don't have that attorney with them at that very first hearing. The clock continues to tick, and time continues to pass by. So I think parents have suffered, and we don't want that for our families anymore. So I approve of this bill going forward, and I hope that others would approve of this bill going forward for the betterment of our community, for the betterment of our parents, for the betterment of the children and the family as a whole. And with that, I say thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Ms. Wade. Thank you for your testimony. And I believe the next testifier is October Allen. So, Ms. Allen, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, and you can begin.
Thank you so much, Vice Chair Mueller. My name is October Allen, and my testimony has to do with my lived experience. So at the age of 12, I was placed into foster care. I grew up in an Indian reservation in Cass Lake, Minnesota. And it's like Lorraine said, it was very rural, not many resources, services, or supports. I went into foster care, and I bounced from foster home to foster home to foster home, and then later entered into the juvenile justice system. I never went back home. As an adult, I asked my mother, "Mom, why didn't I get to go back home?" And she said, "I didn't know that you could." She never knew that she could, and I don't know that she ever had anyone to stand with her or walk her through the scary process that she had entered. Years later, I found myself with my own child protection case. Was there an attorney there to meet me? No, I don't remember that. But what I do remember is I remember sitting there all alone, scared to death, not knowing where my children were, not even realizing what had happened, and really needing help or somebody to speak to me and to tell me the next steps that needed to be taken. It was a long journey and a long process, but I did eventually earn my children back. It was a long road, and I learned a lot of lessons, and I found the courage and the ability to communicate my needs all on my own, to where when I was finally reunified with my children, the judge nominated me to a parent mentor program, and he said, "I have never seen anyone in 40 years do what you have just done. Will you help other parents?" So I have been working with parents for Minnesota One Stop for Communities for 5 years, and I don't see any of them ever having a court-appointed attorney at that first hearing. But we are there. We are there to see the impact that it would make to have counsel appointed at that first hearing. We are there to soften the blow of the trauma that is endured when these parents enter that courtroom. And Representative Becker Finn spoke to, do they qualify? Do they want it? Absolutely. The majority of the parents do qualify. They do want it. And my question is, do they need it? And the answer is yes, they absolutely need it for the betterment of our communities, the safety of our children. And I remember in one of my trainings, I can't quote the senator that spoke to it, but he prided himself in the work that he had done in the child welfare system. And there was a boy that had entered the system and did very well. And at the age of 18, when he graduated out of foster care, the senator asked him, out of all that we have done for you in this system, is there anything more that we could have done? And the child said, you could have went back and helped my mom, because he never got to go home. And so as I stand here today, you guys, actually, as I sit here today, I just am a huge advocate, and I just want to give a voice to those parents that sit there all alone. You know, and I also speak to my mom's experience. I wish there would have been somebody there, because I did grow up to become somebody, and I just really wish somebody would have been there for her. And with that, I thank you for today and all the good work that you guys do. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Allen. And you mentioned the word courage, and we appreciate your courage in coming to the committee today and sharing your story and experience with us. So thank you. Chair Becker-Finn, I believe your next testifier is Wanda Gierman. All right, Ms. Gierman, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and you can begin.
Thank you, Vice Chair Mueller. My name is Wanda Gierman, and I am a child protection attorney in Minnesota. I am a court-appointed attorney in three separate counties in more of the rural areas of Minnesota, and I'm here to tell you a little bit about the differences that I have seen with child protection throughout the years that I've been practicing, specifically with respect to parent attorneys and the differences that I feel we make when we are appointed early on in a case versus later on in a case. I have worked in counties where there isn't a child protection attorney early on in the case, and I've also worked in counties where I've advocated for the county to contract with us to appear not only just one attorney, but an attorney for each parent that appears in child protection cases at the emergency protective care hearing. And I see the differences that it makes with respect to these parents and their ability to successfully work their case plan and be reunified with their children. Some of the benefits are early on when working with the parents, an attorney is able to, first of all, start building trust with our clients where we can then further assist them throughout the entire process. Child protection timelines in Minnesota are very quick. Once a child is removed from a parent's care, their case has to be reviewed within 180 days to determine whether or not the petitioner should move to permanency, which could include termination of their parental rights. And so 6 months is a very short period of time to address any issues in which the parents might have that might need to be addressed. When there's a child protection attorney appointed early on, we can explain to the parent that this isn't a criminal case, that they're not being charged with anything, so to speak, that oftentimes some of the concepts that they might hear, whether it's because they have a friend that's been charged with a crime or on TV where they shouldn't provide statements, they should not cooperate, that it's different in child protection, and oftentimes it helps to talk with a social worker, discuss the issues that you're having, what you could use help with, what they can do in terms of providing services to you, and also explain to them that child protection case isn't just about what's required out of the parent, but it's also about what's required from the county and what services the county can provide them to help remedy whatever situation they're struggling with or that they might have. We can, early on in the case, talk about measures that a parent can take to bring a child home sooner, such as safety plans, assessments that might be needed for mental health and chemical dependency. And if that's not done at the very early stage of the proceeding, the emergency protective care hearing, up to 10 days can pass, and sometimes longer, where that's valuable time for a parent to be able to get in, get an assessment, develop a safety plan with the county, where the child could potentially be returned home sooner. There's also some very important arguments that are made at the first court hearing that a parent faces in child protection. At the emergency protective care hearing, it's basically a hearing where the parent is made aware of why they're being brought before the court, what their rights are with respect to a child protection case, and then the court makes certain findings, one of them being whether or not the child would be immediately endangered if returned home to the care of their parent. And this is ultimately one of the most traumatic type of experiences that a parent can go through, and for them to have to go through that alone and rely on whatever information or knowledge they might have about the system, I can't imagine being in that position. And having an attorney that's there that can tell the court the information that the court needs to know so that the court can make the best decision on something that is going to really impact the case going forward, whether the child can return home or not, is absolutely essential, in my opinion. And so I'm hoping that this bill would be approved. I guess I'm here to answer any questions that anyone might have with respect to the differences that I see in terms of when I haven't been appointed early on in a case and when I'm appointed from the beginning. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Gearman, for your testimony. We appreciate it. And I do note that there are several members with questions. I believe that Chair Becker Finn has a number of other testifiers on standby to help with questions. And we have one more testifier from the public before we get to your questions, and that is Carly Stark. So welcome to the committee, Ms. Stark. Please introduce yourself, and you may begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carly Stark. I am a policy analyst with the Association of Minnesota Counties. For those new members, AMC represents all 87 counties. We are a voluntary association. So I want to start by saying that we recognize the importance of this bill. We recognize the importance of parents having counsel. In 2008, the Public Defender's Office was unable to continue providing that service due to finances. And then that service of providing parent representation was then shifted to the counties without funding. So I think that's good context to understand going forward with this. And also that in many counties, representation is already being provided, but there is a gap with that first hearing, which is generally the emergency protective care hearing. I also want to start by thanking Mitchell Hamlin Institute to Transform Child Protection. They have done a lot of work on this bill, and they have included us in that work to help alleviate the concerns of counties. So I'll quickly touch on the financial issue, even though I know that's not in this committee. As I said, counties provide representation in most cases, and there is no state funding for that when originally it was all funded by the state through the state, Public Defender's Office. We appreciate that there is an appropriation in this, and we urge you to recognize the importance of state support of this issue. You know, the counties do a lot of services, and I think the state also needs to recognize the importance of this. Another thing to point out is that I know some testifiers may talk about 4E funding, which is federal funding, and these representation costs are reimbursable through 4E, but there have been some implementation issues with 4E where counties are not necessarily receiving that reimbursement. So I just want to put that out there. Our concerns for this committee have to do with implementation and liability. In greater Minnesota, there is a limited attorney workforce that is able to join child protection attorney rosters. There are attorneys that are on multiple rosters and must travel a long way on short notice, especially for the first hearing. It happens within 72 hours of when a child is removed from the home. So you have court administration has to get an application for an attorney from the parent and ensure that an attorney gets there on time for the hearing. We understand that virtual court hearings are increasing. Even though it's always better to be in person, those could alleviate some of these issues. However, the counties do not have control over those policies. It is the judicial branch that has control over those policies. So we hope that those are expanded to help with this issues, but we are not in control of that. We want to ensure that if this bill goes through, that it does not lead to actual delays in permanency because an attorney can't be at the first hearing, because there are multiple ways a judge can continue hearings for good cause. And we want to make sure that the good cause of not having an attorney doesn't delay the hearing and ultimately delay reunification of the family. So the last issue is the liability. Even if counties do everything that they can, it may not be possible in some cases to get an attorney to the emergency protective care hearing due to those issues that I mentioned, distance, attorney availability, or even parents not being able to fill out the application quickly enough. We worry that counties could face legal liability in those cases despite putting in a good faith effort to appoint counsel at the first hearing. We're not saying that attorneys shouldn't be appointed and that counties shouldn't try. However, sometimes it may not happen, and we want to ensure that counties are protected, because when counties are sued and have to pay settlement or increase insurance costs, that takes money away from things like human services and the services that these parents and children need to stay unified. Additionally, local court administration plays a large part in facilitating the appointment of counsels. In many counties, the county pays for and creates the roster of attorneys, but the judicial branch is in charge of the policies and procedures regarding actual appointment of counsels, or counsel. The county does not have control over those policies and procedures, despite being the legal entity liable for not providing counsel. Now, the court administration does a great job in a lot of places, but there's just that disconnect between the county who hires the attorney and court administration who has the policies and procedures to make sure that they get appointed. We think this bill has the potential to help parents and create change, but only if implemented and funded properly. We look forward to working with Chair Becker Finn and the Institute to Transform Child Protection on this bill going forward. And I will stick around for questions. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Stark. We appreciate it. Members, it looks like we have six questions, and we do have to stop at 9:55 for a vote, but I think that gives us time for discussion, and I will call on Representative Novotny first. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. Originally, I had a question that I was going to ask, but it was very eloquently answered by Testifier Allen, and I just want to reach out to her and say thank you for your testimony. It was very moving, and thank you for getting on your feet and giving back to the community. You're an example of what everyone should be or should strive for. Moving on, I'll just make a quick statement. I just feel it's very important that the people that are doing this are trained. I believe there was a requirement, but it's been removed, that we have specific training for that. I think that should be a guardrail that we put in place. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Novotny. Chair Becker Finn, did you want to address that last piece?
Yeah, just real quick. Thank you, Madam Chair. So current practice, I mean, attorneys are still receiving training. It's just what we amended out was 18 CLE hours, which is actually a lot of CLE hours. And especially if we're trying to make it easier for more attorneys to jump in and get on this roster, obviously we want folks to be trained. It's just the 18 hours quite a big lift, and we want to make sure that we're being a little more streamlined in our training, but noted. So thank you for your comment, Representative Novotny.
All right, Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to comment that I am so strongly in support of this bill. I have a very good friend who went through this experience and could not afford an attorney to help him with the child protective services situation with his son. And I saw how hard it was, even for somebody who is relatively sophisticated to, you know, as a parent, there is nothing, as Chair Becker Finn said, there is nothing more awful than not having control over the well-being of your child. And so I just think having a dispassionate, skilled attorney is absolutely essential. And I've seen just secondhand over the past year, just how the situation is drawn out and made more complicated and than it needs to be, and how that has really been negative for the child's well-being as well as the parent. So I just strongly support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feist. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to say I love the concept of this bill. My concerns have already been stated. In fact, the chair stated some of them, is just the shortage of attorneys. We don't have enough attorneys to do be public defenders and legal aid attorneys. These people are just in short supply. And then the other concern, of course, is the cost to the counties. And I'm wondering, Chair Becker Finn, if you've requested a fiscal note for this, and obviously it would be a local impact fiscal note. And I know a lot of counties are doing this. I was just texting with a friend that just went through this process with her niece, and she was trying to remember back. It was a Ramsey County case, and she believes that the mother was given a court-appointed attorney right away, but that's not always the case. So there's some of those just logistical things, and if we could clone more attorneys that would be willing to do this work, that would be awesome. So I just wanted Chair Becker Finn's just reaction to those comments.
Chair Becker Finn.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Moeller. So first, I want to just clarify that the problem is that not that we don't have enough public defenders and legal aid attorneys. It's that we don't pay them enough so that it's a choice that folks with law school debt are making. I can personally say there are plenty of people that I graduated with. We have three law schools. We used to have four. We have three law schools in Minnesota. We're turning out plenty of graduates. It's just we don't pay folks enough, and so it's not economically feasible for a lot of folks, even if they would prefer to do this kind of public service work. So part of the expense of the bill, we have requested a fiscal note. I've been in touch with DHS to make sure we have ongoing conversations to make sure that we are, that the fiscal note is as accurate as it can be. Acknowledge that there is some local cost, but the cost of this bill is actually that the state would be paying for this. There is also, and, you know, not to spend way too much time on the financial piece, but there's also the opportunity for public funding or federal funding through 4E funds, which is something that changed in 2018. So that's a relatively new option available for these types of proceedings.
Follow up, Representative Scott?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, next up is Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I recall when I was a public defender before they made the switch to counties paying for this, representing clients in CHIPS cases, and I recall how those cases went differently because they had representation at the beginning, how much hope that the individual, that the parent had, because they had a lawyer that could help them work through the system, and they had confidence in that. They also felt that the system was more fair because it provided them with that representation. When I hear us discuss the costs, what I think we have to think about is the cost to society when we don't provide this type of representation within a system that many folks that are being impacted don't have familiarity with. They don't know how to represent themselves, and it's created huge inequities within our society. And so we have to think about that cost. I'm 1,000% behind this bill to help alleviate some of those inequities. And I just think we always need to keep that in mind when we're thinking about passing legislation. Will it cure an inequity? Will it stop exacerbating inequities that we have? And I think this bill will help do that.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Becker Finn, for bringing this bill. I am behind the principle of this and the need for it. The reason I raised my hand, however, is I do have some heartburn about the funding in the bill, that you're putting this in the human services budget. And I really think we need to just, there's obviously this is not a simple funding issue. And I think there's just, I certainly am going to vote for the bill, but I wanted to say that by doing so, I'm not giving the yes, we can to the funding source, because, I really think there's some concern there. And Ms. Stark discussed some of this and kind of highlighted how many issues there are to unpack. So I really hope that we can do some work, and looking forward to seeing what the fiscal note is. But I really would love to at least get started on this, because I really do feel like this is such a huge equity issue. It's such a huge issue about our kids and our future. And, you started out saying, Chair Becker-Finn, about, how it's traumatizing for kids to be separated from their parents. And it should never happen unless it's absolutely necessary. And this is one way to help that. So it has so many great impacts, a bill like this, but I just really want to be cautious about how we put the funding together. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Chair Becker-Finn, did you have a comment?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Mueller. And I guess I encourage members to, instead of saying this is great, but that we start thinking about it as far as this is great and we need to figure out how to fund this. And, we're still working on that. We're still having those conversations, but we thought it was important to sort of get this stop, this committee stop, getting things going and really raising the conversation so folks are thinking about why it's important that we figure out that funding piece, because this just is, this is one of those issues where I think we need to push ourselves to figure out how to do it. And I've never been one to shy away from taking on bills that are difficult, but I think that this one is incredibly important. And I do want to just point out too that some counties are already doing this and are already paying for that, and that's great. And what we want to make sure is that no matter what county a child and a parent live in, that they would have access to that same type of assistance through having counsel. And finally, since I don't see any other hands, I'll just say that our current system favors solid permanent answers, and that makes sense because we want there to be stability for children. But we also need to make sure then that the rights of parents are being fully heard from the outset, because this is a permanent thing. And this bill specifically, in the types of cases we're talking about, it's CHIPS cases, but it's also termination of parental rights. And I can tell folks just from anecdotally from the people I know who have faced these kinds of hearings that once your parental rights are terminated, that is it. And that is really heartbreaking to think that a parent's rights could be terminated when they didn't even understand what was happening or how the system was working and what that means. And so I think, it's not, it's about the rights of parents, but it is also about what's best for kids. And as we heard in the testimony, especially from Ms. Allen, kids always want to go home. your parents are always your parents. And so I think that's, we don't want to be unnecessarily separating children from their parents. And that's really what this is about, in making sure that all sides are properly heard in these kinds of cases. So I thank you, members, for your questions and the testifiers too, for the really moving testimony. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. And I don't see any other member questions. So with that, Representative Becker-Finn renews her motion that House File 312, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. And the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
Too much work to be done on this, Madam Chair. I got to be a no. There's too much work to be done on this before you move it forward.
Representative Herr. Excused. Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
No.
Representative Novotny. Representative Novotny, aye. Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Robbins.
Sorry, aye.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
I have 12 ayes and 4 nays.
There being 12 ayes and 4 nays, the motion prevails. House File 312, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Human Services, Finance, and Policy Committee. And I am virtually tapping the gavel and handing the gavel back over to Chair Beckerfin.
Thank you, Vice Chair Mueller, for ably handling our discussion there. I do want to say, members, during the vote, that is not a time to make comments. It's aye or no. Those are your two options while voting. It's not the appropriate time to make comments about why a certain vote is happening. That's where the discussion period is. So thank you, members, for a good start to the week. Our next hearing will be February 11th. We do have 3 bills on our agenda on Thursday, so come prepared. Make sure you read your bills, and we'll be ready to work on Thursday. So thank you, everybody, for being on time and keeping your questions efficient, and we are adjourned.